Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Finding someone on an online Catholic dating site shouldn't be like shopping for a blender. So why do most dating sites leave you feeling like you're shopping for a spouse? At Catholic Singles, we connect members through our unique user polls and activities, which help you discover other members and their personalities and interests. Because you're a person, not a profile picture. So stop shopping and start discerning. Trust your love story to the original Catholic dating site and use the promo code BREADBOX at checkout for 20% off at catholicsingles.com.
Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Hollow is here to help. Hollow is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Hollow has something for everyone. Hollow is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.hollow.app/breadbox.
Off the shelf here on Redbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Thompson, Catholic blogger. Today we have with us Jared Stout. He's the author of the new book, Restoring Humanity. Jared's been with us before to discuss his book, The Beer Option, which was a rather interesting read. This one's totally different than what we experienced before. So welcome to the show, Jared.
Thank you for having me.
So as I mentioned, it's a unique book. It's a collection of essays, but they all have a common thread. Can you give us somewhat of a 10,000-foot view of the book, how it came to be, and why you found it important to write it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it came about over a number of years, teaching and writing about the evangelization of culture. I'm just so convinced, following the lead of St. John Paul II, that culture is really crucial for living out the Christian life, especially in a secular world. In the past, we could really take so much for granted in culture, you know, that the culture was relatively wholesome, supported family life, and was not in as much of a contradiction with our faith. And so there is this big gap now between our daily life and what we believe. And the book is really designed to help overcome that gap and to really look at everything that we do, our relationship to nature, our family life, our work, education, and our efforts of evangelization as all meant to overcome this gap and to help us to live out our faith on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we hear that word culture a lot, and I think many of us don't grasp its meaning. Can you kind of pull back the curtain a bit and tell us what culture is and why it's important, or rather vital to us today?
Yeah, you know, and culture is used in a lot of different ways. You know, you have high culture when you think of, like, going to the symphony or the opera. You have pop culture when you think about, you know, what we're watching on TV and the music we're listening to. But culture is a really important word, and it really just means, in its most basic form, how we live. What are the beliefs and practices that we share with other people in our community that make up our way of life? And so, you know, I think we can look at culture in a number of different ways. I mean, even within a family, there is such a thing as family culture. That is, within my own community here in the home and my family, you know, what we really believe and how we live. But we're not in isolation, right? You know, we're within the broader American culture, and there's, you know, intermediaries in between there as well.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think the church... at least I seem to see this, and you speak about it in the introduction. Why has the church turned to speaking of and writing about culture more in recent times?
you know, I think it is because of that split that I was talking about. I mean, we can kind of look at the breakdown of Christian culture from the Reformation, which really was the split in European culture between North and South, and moving from this holistic view of the faith permeating everything to creating a kind of secularism where the reformers, you know, were emphasizing this theology of the word and theology of faith, and kind of left things to run their own course and the society and culture surrounding. I mean, Martin Luther created this kind of dualism. And this only got worse. The Enlightenment actually picked up that split and made the secular and natural more important than the supernatural. And then we see all of these political revolutions beginning, especially with the French Revolution, the Industrial Revolution. All of these things are putting more and more of a split between faith and daily life. You know, it's this really long kind of arc. And I think in the midst of that, the church has had to then pay more attention to our daily life and that split. And so it's also because, you know, within German philosophy, people began paying more attention to culture as a phenomenon as well. But in my mind, pastorally speaking, the church began to recognize we need to do something about the problem with culture, with how people are living in the world, and help Christians to begin bringing faith into culture, not only for their own sake, but for a healing of the culture, restoring of humanity, right, as I have in the title, and to actually begin to draw people back to Christ through this evangelization of culture.
Mm-hmm. So in our time today, I'd like to highlight some of these essays and pull some talking points from them. And the first essay you have is entitled A Catholic View of History and Culture. And within that essay, you speak of the role of the Gospels in shaping our culture. Can you give us some insight into how that is?
Yeah, you know, I really what I'm trying to do in that chapter is point out that there are still Catholics today who would say the church doesn't really need to worry about culture. You know, really we need to worry about faith and living a good Christian life. And, well, hey, I mean, the culture is bigger than us, and so it's not our responsibility. But really, when we look closely at the vision of the entire Bible, from the Old Testament to even the book of Revelation, what we see there is that God absolutely wants to form a complete way of life. And the gospel is meant to be lived, right? Jesus didn't just say, have faith in me, and then you're good, you're done, right? And, you know, when you read the gospels carefully, that's not what Jesus is talking about at all. And so in that chapter, I look carefully at the incarnation and with God becoming man, taking on flesh, that's actually the center of the restoration of humanity. God came to us, not to just get us away from the world, but to enter into our world and our community and even the world of culture and to begin to transform that from within. And the Eucharist is an ongoing image of that, that Christ continues to take on flesh to us and the church, and by entering, you know, into our lives, we then become a continuation of the incarnation in the world, and we become this leaven for transformation of the world in a way that even anticipates the complete restoration of humanity that will come in the book of Revelation. Mm-hmm. And that's already beginning to happen in an incomplete way now.
Right, right. As we move on into chapter two, the sacramentality of each moral thing. To start with, can you define what you mean by each moral thing?
Yes. Well, each moral thing is every created thing in the world that depends upon God for its existence, right? You know, God is immortal, and everything that he created in the physical world, you know, is going to die, but each mortal thing, each thing that he breathes into existence, is a participation in his own life. And in this chapter, I'm really trying to show that everything is a sacrament. Mm-hmm. You know, not one of the seven sacraments, of course, but insofar as the word becomes the agent of creation, right? He had an image, an idea, that is, of everything that he created in the divine mind. And that becomes the exemplar, kind of like the blueprint from which he created everything. And so when it actually is taking on flesh, each mortal thing then becomes the sacrament of the divine life in a way that we're imaging God, right? You know, man and women image God in a very particular way, But everything in the universe teaches us about God and the divine mind in some way.
Mm-hmm. And in that chapter, you write about this giving glory to God in that essay. And this line struck me as you were writing about Hopkins' poetry. And the quote is, "To lift up the hands in prayer gives God glory. But a man with a dung fork in his hand, a woman with a slop pail gives him glory too," end quote. And I think we often forget that. We think that we have to do these great acts of grandeur to be glorifying God, but it's not doesn't have to be that difficult, does it?
Yeah, and that's really the heart of the sacramentality, that God wants to be present with us in all the different particularities of our life. And so when we are really kind of lifting our hands up in prayer, yes, but also in work, it's very Benedictine in that sense, this the work itself then becomes a kind of prayer, that is a way of giving God glory. And this comes out in a few chapters in a kind of secondary way, but through our work, we become co-creators with God. Like he gives us this mission to continue and even perfect the work of creation. That's with that, you know, subduing the earth and Adam having the task in the garden, you know, caring and tilling for the earth. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, absolutely. God wants us to bring all things kind of back to him, you know, through our work and through our prayer to give him glory.
Mm-hmm. And then as we move through the book, we come to, will beauty save the world? How do you define beauty in this context, in this chapter?
Yeah, you know, I think it's important that I put that out there as a question. Will beauty save the world? It's from Dostoevsky, his novel, The Idiot. And actually, both Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict XVI have quoted that line from Dostoevsky. And so I am looking at different kinds of beauty because I'm really playing off of one another this kind of sensual beauty that could really mislead us in the end, right? When you see something is beautiful on the surface, it's attractive, right? And I even quote Eve, you know, where the fruit tempted her, you know, by its desirability. Versus the kind of beauty that is this transcendental, this perfection of being that really illuminates the intellect, right, and inspires the will towards what is truly good. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of misleading beauty out there, which I call vanity, right? You know, and so we can't just stop at the surface. You know, just going to an art museum, you know, and looking at all the beautiful art there will not save you. Right. Mm-hmm. Even though there's a lot of inspiring things in the art museum, it really is the beauty of Christ. And to quote, you know, Cardinal Ratzinger in this chapter, right, this is a beauty that pierces our heart. It's something deeper than a sensual beauty that really, you know, pulls us out of just our normal way of living and really inspires us and draws us up to the higher goods, the goods that are most worthy. And so really it's the beauty of Christ that saves us. Mm-hmm. Not just any old beauty, right? But the beauty of Christ that can even reach down into our sufferings. And so can we find the beauty of life sometimes in unexpected places, right? And I get into Flannery O'Connor and her view of violence and the grotesque a little bit in this chapter, mm-hmm. to kind of show that the most beautiful one, Christ, has become the most disfigured for us on the cross. And that is the moment of redemption. And it's a great image of the world, right? The world is very beautiful, but we know it's fallen. And we experience a lot of sin and suffering. And so in the midst of that, we really need Christ to redeem it and show us the deeper beauty that comes to us beyond the surface level.
Mm-hmm. So I guess one thing that I think we need to bring up is, how can each of us be a beacon of or reflection of the beauty that the world needs?
Yeah, and, you know, I think what comes out even in this chapter on beauty, this is once again quoting Cardinal Ratzinger, and he references again as Pope Benedict, that the saints become icons of Christ. And we know the saints have suffered a lot as well. And so in the call of holiness that we all receive, we also are meant to be icons of Christ. That somebody should look at us, and we know we're not going to be perfect, so I'm not trying to be overly sentimental. Like, everyone will look at us, and they'll just see Christ shining through us. But mm-hmm. we do hope that, right? And through mm-hmm. our prayer, through our work, through our family life, that people would see that, and they would say, there's something different there. You know, there's a kind of joy that I don't see other places. And even though there's suffering there, there's still this kind of hope and strength through it. And this person believes in something. They're working for something bigger than themselves. And we really want that to become this witness of Christ and this icon of Christ in the world.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back to discuss more of Restoring Humanity with Jared Stout. You've been listening to Off the Shelf. We'll be right back.
Are you married? I'd like to suggest that you often return to the fond and true memory of your spouse when you first met and on your wedding day. Well, he or she is still that same lovable person. Perhaps life has presented many challenges you did not expect back then, but you have come through these together. And the providential fire of your tribulations and your love has forged you into the one body you are today, and that is a beautiful thing. Never let anyone or any inferior thing tear you and your spouse asunder. God is one with you. He is love. Your marriage is love. And love endures whatever comes. It does not come to an end. See 1 Corinthians 13. I'm Jim Littleton of FormingFaithfulFamilies.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf. We're spending today with Jared Stout to discuss his book, Restoring Humanity. And Jared, when we come to chapter 4, this is a rather interesting chapter or essay. The land is a place for evangelization. And throughout history, land has played a key role in faith and life. In our technologically driven society, how important is it for us to return to our roots and in turn the land to kind of recapture that identity and faith?
Yeah, I think it's vital in the true sense of that word that we're missing something. Mm-hmm. We are alienated from the land and from nature right now. And, you know, I just want to say right away, it's easy to become overly romantic about that. You know, I'm going to move out in the middle of nowhere and I'm going to get 10 acres of land and I'm going to have animals and we're going to live this perfect ideal life. I have friends that have actually done that and it has worked, but I know other people who have tried it and it's failed miserably. So I just want to say that it's not, what I'm not saying is that everyone has to move on to the land to own a large portion of land, et cetera. That's very noble and good if you can do it. But what I think I am saying is through our work, through our leisure and recreation, and even in the spiritual life, when you think of retreats and, you know, just being even outdoors as a family, having this time to kind of recharge, we need to be in connection to the land because God made us for that. You know, when we go back once again to the first two chapters of Genesis, we see this. You know, God places Adam in the garden and he gives him a task in the garden. And when you look at the life of Israel, what was it? It was a promise for a holy people in a holy land, right? And so every Israelite was allotted his own portion of the land to care for. And even the Jubilee year, every, you know, the Sabbath of Sabbath years, 50th year was a time when the land had to go back to its original owner because it could not even be alienated from that original owner because it was a patrimony. Now, obviously, that's not absolute, and I look at, you know, what happened in Acts of the Apostles. Israelites were actually selling their ancestral land and bringing the money and placing it at the feet of the church. And so, once again, the goal is not necessarily to have a lot of land, you know, but it is to fulfill the cultural mission that God has given us through our work in a way that respects the land and works with the land. And it also is recognizing that from a spiritual perspective, we need that, right? You know, mm-hmm. We need to have this connection with nature. And because people are looking for it so much, I think there are ways that the church can build upon that for evangelization. You know, I there are some concrete examples here, you know, Madonna House, Catholic Worker Farms. And I've actually done retreats on the land as well. You know, I worked with a Wyoming Catholic to do a family retreat up on a ranch, and I've done some other things in the Archdiocese of Denver, and I think that is very attractive to people because it speaks into something we're missing, a key part of culture, right? Land being this kind of important foundation for it.
Another key thing I think about restoring humanity is mentioned in the chapter, the family. The family is a builder of Christian culture. And all the way back to the early church, the family has always played an integral role in the growth of Christianity. To do this, I believe the church needs to support the family unit. And with the pandemic and closing of churches, what does the church need to do to reverse the trend that people may be picking up that faith in the church doesn't matter, considering many got an 8-week plus free pass?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I really do think this is a crucial element of the overall vision of, you know, evangelizing culture. Why? Because where do people learn to live the faith? Well, first and foremost, it's in the home. And you can even look at some statistics on this. Christian Smith, in his book, Young Catholic America, said, and look, and we all know this, right? But parents have by far the largest influence in the faith life of their kids. And so it's not enough to you know, just bring your children to a Catholic school or to the Catholic parish and say, okay, I'm going to farm this out to you, right? You pass on the faith to my kids. It's something that absolutely has to come from the parents. And this is key to what I'm trying to say in this chapter, that it's not enough just to go to Mass or to say that you believe. There has to be practices within the home. And so the key thing for building culture, whether it's in my own life or my family life, is habits of prayer. Because what that does, it basically opens the door to God to live in me and in everything that I do. So regular prayer throughout the day, I think, is the most important kind of cultural practice we can form. You can say, how's that a cultural practice? Well, when it's shaping time, shaping my day, shaping my week, shaping the year, then time becomes a way of guiding culture. I think it's also forming the imagination of our kids. You know, we can say, yes, we're Catholic, we believe, but then what do your kids watch on TV? What are they listening to? What books are they reading? And if their imagination is being formed in a way that contradicts the faith, well, we're back to that split then that we were talking about before, this big rupture. And so that's crucial. I mean, families need to read the Bible together, the lives of saints, create literature together, talk about it. Parents need to be really involved in the education of their children, wherever they're going to school, whether at home, Catholic school, public school. Parents need to know what they're learning and need to be involved in that and help their kids to think through the big questions of life. And families need to form practices together, mm-hmm. practices of recreation and work, you know, inside the home, yard, and really do things together. Because, you know, when you read about the breakdown of the family, a lot of scholars say it's because families don't do things together, mm-hmm. Even eat meals together. They don't need each other in their life. Everybody's off doing their own thing. But, and then, you know, on this final point that I make in the chapter, I think it speaks into what you're talking about, even with the crisis and what's going on at parishes, that when we look at parishes, you know, there's Bible studies for adults, or there are youth programs or educational programs for youth. But what you don't see a lot is direct support for families. And what kind of support do families need? Well, I think they need community with other families. And, you know, families don't have to wait around for the parish to do that, but it can help, right? The parish can kind of be a hub of family culture, of families supporting one another and working towards common goals together, because the family cannot stand alone, mm-hmm. you know, against the culture with all the challenges that we have. We really need families standing up together. And it's even important for the kids. They see, like, oh, other families are doing this too. It's not just my crazy family, you know, doing this. So I think it's a crucial way of rebuilding culture is that families working together on these principles.
You know, this next chapter, Living the Truth, Forming Culture as a Goal of Education, I saw a meme recently that went something like, you know, universities closing from COVID may not be a bad thing because we can bypass the indoctrination. Yeah. So how can we save... How can educators play a role in restoring culture, and what steps need to be taken to stop this apparent indoctrination that's occurring in our school systems today?
Yeah, this is you know, going back to something I just said, that, well, first of all, if you're a parent, you need to really know what your kids are learning. You know, there are public educators who speak openly, they're not even hiding it anymore, about indoctrinating kids on the issues that we all know are really being discussed in public education. So parents really need to be informed of what their kids are learning. They need to be involved in that. I would really recommend, you know, Catholic education in whatever form you can get it, because, you know, if we just say, well, you know, our kids are going to go to public school, but we'll teach them the faith at home, there's really a split and a disconnect, and they're going to be learning different things. And they spend so much time in school that whatever they're learning there, you know, it's really going to be sticking. So you need to really, you know, be vigilant, I think, at this point about what kids are learning. And there are so many other supplemental things as well, as I was mentioning, that really forming the mind and the imagination in the home. But I think that at this point in time, you know, we really need to open our eyes about, okay, what really is the goal of public education? What is really happening there? And what is the true goal of education? Now, what I'm arguing in this chapter is that, yes, we're learning about things, but the true goal of education is to be someone and to really live in the truth. And so we're not just getting information, we're not just getting training for a future career, but the point of education is really to draw out the potential of human life and to develop it according to what is true, good, and beautiful, and to really not only learn the truth, but to really live according to what is good for us and what will really make us happy. And that's what education is all about. And it's definitely something we've lost sight of. And I want to say not only in public education, but as we know, you know, in many Catholic schools as well.
Right. And in that next chapter, The University and a Transmission of Culture, you kind of touch upon Catholic schools as well in that chapter. And, you know, we're seeing these Catholic schools closing in what seems to be an accelerated rate here in recent years. And this whole pandemic is not helping you know, the pocketbooks are getting lighter and they're not getting the money they need. How can we save our Catholic schools to ensure those values can be taught to the next generation?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And this is actually my main job. I'm the associate superintendent of schools in Denver, focused on mission and the formation of leaders. So I hope I can answer this question, but, you know, really, I think that the biggest thing is that we have to know why we exist as Catholic schools. You know, if we're just doing what the public schools do in a private setting, well, that's not good enough, and we really should close our schools. We have to be places of discipleship, and whether that's, you know, elementary school, high school, or a university, they have to be places where we can live the Christian faith, because there really are communities where you're not only learning the truth, right, but you're forming habits, you're worshiping together, you're reconnecting to the lost past. And I think that's a crucial thing. We have such an amazing heritage in Catholic education. You know, really, we invented Western education as we know it in terms of taking, you know, the classical tradition from the Greeks and Romans, and then really turning that into a complete vision of education and starting schools that are more widespread. You know, this comes out of the church's own heritage. But we have so much, you know, amazing literature, art, and history to learn that we need to pass on to our kids, because I think they're not getting it and we're feeling disconnected. And so the church really is seeming pretty remote, and that whole heritage is unknown and just kind of sitting out there. So it's really, I think, reappropriating our core mission and our identity as Catholic schools and showing parents why that is compelling. And I think there's plenty of data even out there that if you look at classical education, for instance, classical education does not teach to a test. And yet kids who are classically educated do better on tests. Why? Well, it's because if we teach our kids how to think and how to have good habits, then whether that's academic habits or moral habits, that will then translate into success. But it's like if you just go after the success, it ends up becoming shallow, and education really loses its depth. Mm-hmm.
And as we wrap up today, skipping ahead to the last chapter, St. John Paul II on the new evangelization and culture. What role does each of us play in the new evangelization and the restoration of culture, particularly in, you know, the environment and climate we're in today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there can be a lot of anxiety when we think about the culture as a whole, you know, even especially with what's going on right now, and we can say, it's lost. It's gone. You know, Christian culture is gone. You know, a lot of the culture, again, of our country is gone. And we can kind of get into a dark place if we focus on that.
Right.
And what I really want everyone to see in the book, in this last chapter on John Paul, is a great example of that. If we look at what John Paul did in Poland, right, he didn't go into Poland and say, what we need is a mass uprising. Everybody go get a gun, and we're going to overthrow the communists. What he actually did was to call people not only to faith, which was crucial, right? You think of "We One God," right? In Warsaw, "We One God," you know, a million people chanting that at once. But he also said, we need to say no to lying. He said, because the communist culture is based on lies and deception. And so there was that kind of honesty that created a moral revolution in Poland. And I think that's very important. And even when we go back to family life, we go back to education, we begin to see how this really is, these are the building blocks that we need to rebuild. We can't just kind of wave a wand and the culture is going to be great and it's going to be Christian again. But if we, you know, in our parish and as groups of families can just help people to start living out the faith, you know, that really is what the new evangelization is seeking to overcome, the secularism that Christians face in daily life. Because the new evangelization is a call of baptized and non-practicing Christians to begin living out their faith again. That's what John Paul said the goal is. And he said that culture, forming culture, is a priority of the new evangelization. Well, why? Well, look at the problem, right? People aren't living the Christian faith. And so that's what we need to do, right, is to show people these are easy and concrete ways that we can start living as Christians in the modern world. And we need to start shaping our institutions, making our parishes vibrant places for families and for discipleship, making our schools to be centers of evangelization where we're forming disciples and we're true to our mission. We need to be faithful to this vision in our work and in our own prayer life. And, you know, if we start doing that in our own local community with as many people as we can kind of gather together, that will really start sending out ripple effects. And I think, once again, it's something we actually can do versus then just focusing on all the problems.
Mm-hmm. Jared, where can people find your book, Restoring Humanity?
Well, the publisher is Divine Providence Press, so you can go to their website. It's an imprint of Wise Blood Books, which focuses on fiction and poetry, but this is a non-fiction imprint. And then, of course, you can also go on Amazon.
All right, Jared, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule today. Any closing thoughts?
My pleasure. Yeah, you know, I think, once again, there is so much anxiety and discouragement right now. And I think that we should have confidence in the Lord. And if we stay close to him in prayer, you know, we will allow him to come into our lives. And from, you know, his presence in us, I think we can start doing some of these things that we've been talking about.
With that, you've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, Catholic Book Blogger. Until next time.
Looking for exceptional coffee delivered fresh to your door? We have the answer. Our friends at Grim Bean Coffee produce small batch artisan coffee using top-tier coffee beans. The coffee is roasted when you order, guaranteeing the freshest coffee possible. Check out Breadbox Roasts, a new line of Catholic-themed coffees available at www.grimbeancoffee.com/breadboxmedia. Experience coffee like never before.